Okay, we'll get started. Dr. Mark, Vakasha, will Gomel on a plane, maybe in COVID, more of a reason to say Gomel, not for the flight, but for being next to other passengers. But that was last week. Okay.
That's a good point. Although I'll return to it for a second. Yeah, we still have maybe two more classes dealing with Orach Chaim, you know, the sections of the Shulchan Aruch dealing with everyday things. And we're going to see some really interesting stuff today as well. Before we go on, just a couple of things. This could be in the next volume. I was asked a question, believe it or not, last week. A non-Jewish student at my university, a graduate student who was in a class of mine, emailed me. She has a Jewish fiance. She wanted to know if I'm a Reformed rabbi, if I could do the marriage. Why is she asking that? Because the magistrate in Scranton is not open. And she wants to get married. Now, the interesting thing is that obviously I told her no, but I have a suspicion that the fiance is not really Jewish, only patrilineal Jewish. So I'm wondering whether it would be okay to do a civil marriage. Is there any issues about a clergyman doing a civil marriage for two people who aren't Jewish? As far as I know, there aren't, but that was the interesting question. Rabbi Kelman mentioned Birkas HaGomel. After the class, I looked up Rav Moshe's Tshuva here, and also Rabbi Greenblatt. What I found is very interesting. In Orach Chaim number 59, Nun Tes, Rav Moshe goes through his whole understanding of it. He explains why the car you don't need. But he says that you should always make a Gomel on an airplane. He says it doesn't matter whether you're going across the ocean or whether you're over dry land. He says, I know that there are people who say only to make the bracha on over the ocean, but he says, I think you should always make the bracha. And if you look in Rabbi Greenblatt, Riv Vos Ephraim, volume 1, number 155, he mentions how Rav Moshe came to Memphis to see, you know, what was doing there with Rabbi Greenblatt. And Rav Moshe then told him that he's only going to make the bracha when he returns to New York. Because if it's a journey, that is, you go and then you return, Rav Moshe held you only make it when you return. So all the people, let's say, go to Israel, but then they're planning on coming home, you'd only make it when you come home. But again, that this is, you know, you don't go over any ocean when you go to Memphis, but Rav Moshe held you always make it, which is definitely not the minhag. And finally, after seeing this, I just Googled to see if anyone discussed it. And I saw that Rabbi Jachter, Chaim Jachter, has an article on it. And he actually quotes Rav Lichtenstein in the name of Rav Soloveitchik, who said the same thing that Rabbi Greenblatt told me, that if you perceive airplane travel to be dangerous, then you recite HaGomel. But otherwise, you don't. And it has nothing to do with oceans, not oceans. So that's interesting. One other point. I mentioned the yeshiva of the Kav last class. Those of you who know, who follow Israeli news, might have seen this was a headline on Serugim and other places. Here's the headline. You can see it here. Rosh Yeshiva Masbir Lama Eini Rotzeh Rami Mehar Hamor. The Rosh Yeshiva of Hezri Yeshiva, I think in Holon, explaining why he won't hire Rebbe's from this Har Hamor, and we spoke a little bit about Har Hamor, and when I get to Rabbi Avinir, who sent me materials later, I will tell you more about them. I mentioned the Har Hamor. They're really the fundamentalists. They have a list of all the negative. The number one enemy for them is Har Etzion, because the Michal at Herzog, they can't stand Tanakh study at Herzog. And then you get the Merkaz people, and basically everyone is Pasul. They're as closed-minded as the most closed-minded peoples you can imagine, even though they're very Zionistic. Okay, let us begin now. When someone asked me, Marat Dayan, if it bothered, about the question I had. That would be, I think, maybe if you did a Jewish ceremony, but if it was just a civil ceremony, I don't know. Why David Kay says it's usher to officiate, please send text sources on it. Because as a civil servant, let's say, if you like are a judge or something, I don't think anyone would say that that's a problem. Last class, I introduced the issue we're going to discuss. And before I get to the issue of lighting the candles But before I do that, I want to set the stage even further to introduce you to some off my, wrong page there. So remember, we're going into a tshuva of this individual, Rav Dov Lior, who's still active. And but before, to set the stage, to understand what was going on, I need to tell you a little bit about this individual. And this is, as you see, this is Rav Yitzhak Abadi of Lakewood. So let me tell you a little bit about him, because there's a number of responsa in the book related to stuff of Rabbi Abadi. Some of you might know him because there's two websites that follow him and put forth his ideas. One is kosher.org and one is Ohel Torah. So he is an individual, was from Venezuela in his youth, I think 3 years old, moved to Eretz Yisrael. Then he studied for a number of years in Hebron. He left Eretz Yisrael to go to Montreux, Switzerland. There was a yeshiva there. There's the yeshiva in Montreux, Switzerland. You might recall Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg was in Montreux, Switzerland, but he wasn't associated with the yeshiva, but there was a little community there. And they had a yeshiva there, the oldest yeshiva in Switzerland. It goes on Aliyah in the 1980s. It now is a Hesder yeshiva in Kochav Yaakov. It's called Hechel Eliyahu. Even though it was like an Agudist yeshiva in Switzerland, you had, as we know, many Agudistin who were really what we call Poli Agudistin, you know, more in the religious Zionist frame. And it, and then he came, after spending a year there, he came to Lakewood. He came to Lakewood in 1953, I believe. He studied with Rav Aharon for almost 10 years. He was a Ben Bayis at Rav Aharon Cutler's house, very, very close to Rav Aharon. Perhaps because he comes from the Sephardic background, he made his focus on halacha l'maaseh, a practical halacha. After Rav Aharon died, I don't know how many years afterwards, he was appointed the official Rosh Yeshiva, official posek of the Lakewood Yeshiva. There were problems. The problems were not because of some of his unusual psakim, which I'll tell you about. I mean, when I was in high school, I still remembered we knew about the posek in Lakewood who said that all gum is kosher. That's one of his ideas. All gum is kosher, because at the end of the day, all the flavoring is kosher. The only issue is the, so if you look, there's an article online by the late Rabbi Zusha Blech. It's called Gum Zum Latova. And he talks about, and what's the issue? He talks about the gum base and everything. But Rabbi Abadi says, and he brings, if you know, you take your baseball mitt and you can chew, it's made of pigskin, right? You can chew on it all you want. You're not eating it. So he says, we don't care about what's in the, you know, the base. He lasted as in Lakewood with the yeshiva into the early 1980s. And remember, he was the official posek of the yeshiva with an office. He had a seat up front. After davening, you'd have I spoke to someone who was there during that time. He said you'd have 10, 15 people online after every davening to ask him shilas. And all the poskim and all the talmidim would ask him the shilas. And some were very close to Talmidim, Rav Gissinger, for instance. You can thank Rav Gissinger maybe for the interest in bugs and everything that we have today, because this goes back to Rav Abadi. Rav Gissinger was a big Talmud, and all of them were Talmidim. But it was a problem. And he basically was sort of pushed out of Lakewood. And if you speak to the people in the know, and I spoke to someone who actually, I won't say his name, but is actually in the yeshiva, works in the yeshiva. What happened was he was becoming too popular, I guess, in the Rebbetzin. Rav Schneier had to travel a lot. He had to raise money. And it's a problem. You know, the yeshiva belongs to the Cutler family. And it's the way it was explained to me is he was creating, Rav Abadi was creating like a separate seat of power, even if he wasn't intentionally doing it. But he was becoming, you know, more popular than the Rosh Yeshiva, because he was was constantly having involvement, and this was creating issues with the Rebbetzin. And the guy I spoke to in Lakewood said they made all sorts of suggestions to him, like, you know, you can become chief rabbi of Mexico, all sorts of things to try to. And in the end, I don't know if he was actually ever officially fired, let go, or he quit, and he left the yeshiva in the early 80s. He opened up Kol, then he went to Israel, and now he's back in Lakewood. Incidentally, his biggest follower, ironically, because after the break with Lakewood, You know, he sort of they tried the yeshiva itself, you know, tried to like leave him out, I guess, in the cold, and they appointed other poskim, and so the young people today might not even know, you know, his involvement with the yeshiva. But his big student today, and the one who carries on his ideas, is none other than Rav Baruch Simon of Yeshiva University. Rav Baruch Simon, who's a posek now, and for the young generation of rabbis coming out of YU, he used to go to Lakewood, and learn with him. Now he does on the phone. Okay, so what can we say about this Rav Abadi, and why does it lead to the questions? Well, first of all, he publishes two volumes of Tshuvot. You can see them on HebrewBooks.org or Yitzchak. Before I tell you about the Tshuvot we're going to talk about, he's very interesting and very unusual. Doesn't in Hebrew they have an expression Poseach al Shnei Seipim, you know, that you're on both sides because you find incredible chumras. Like to give you an example of one of his chumra, he rules Halacha L'Maisa. Well, first of all, he rules you can't have baseball cards. He has a whole tshuva against baseball cards. But in a more serious thing, he says that male photographers cannot photograph the women at a wedding. Now, I've been to very, very firm weddings, and I've never once seen where they have female photographers. In fact, they would probably say female photographers are not sneas. But he holds it's absolutely usher for male photographers. But he also has unbelievable, what you might call kulas. He never got with the program of American Orthodoxy. He just follows Shulchan Aruch. When you learn Shulchan Aruch, if you learn it, you're a daya. All of a sudden, you learn things and you wonder, well, if this is the halacha. So, for instance, try serving cold cuts on a dairy plate next Shabbos. No balabasta would do that. They think you're crazy. Yet, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, try to explain why you can't. So, Rav Abadi does not believe in hashgachas. He doesn't believe in hashgachas at all. It's all the ingredients. And a Pesach also. All the Pesach foods with the OU and the P, he doesn't accept any of that. He says only for cheese and meat. Everything is based on ingredients. And that's the sheet of the two websites. And I can explain, if you're interested, later at the end of class, why he holds that you don't need any of these hashkachas. And you know what? If you're living in Australia, if you're living in England, you're living all over the world, you won't understand why what the hashkachas are either, because they don't have hashkachas in those countries. And even in places like England, you don't have rabbis visiting factories. They have these lists and everything. But and he also is responsible for the silk screen Sefer Torah. This sort of also pushed him out of Haredi society. You can Google this later and watch the YouTube, one of his students. Basically, what it is you have a silk screen and you have a squeegee and you put the ink down and it has like, and you roll it like this, and that would get rid of all the mistakes. Everyone can have their own Sefer Torah. And he has a whole long tshuva of like 30 pages. Rabbi Bleich in one of his volumes deals with it. And he holds that that's safras. It doesn't need to be individual. You don't have to do each individual letter. You can do 10 letters at a time or 50 letters at a time with your hands. So that never, as you can imagine, that never would be accepted. Just too novel. Although when you think about it, it's not any more novel, I think, than machine matzahs. But in any event, and he has other unusual ideas at all. Interesting about Seder, he holds, it's in the Sefer that, you know, so today if we remember, we try to do a Seder. He says today you don't need to do a Seder on Pesach. He says, the Ravya already says you don't. He says, today, no one feels comfortable to do a seva. It's not the way we normally sit. Like in Roman days, they sit back and everything. And therefore, he says that, if you're not ruggy, or if you're not used to reclining on Pesach, there's no need to recline. So lots of original ideas. The other Hebrew expression is he doesn't go by the holach batelim, you know, doesn't follow what other people say. So all sorts of unusual stuff. So what is the unusual thing that I wrote to these two great rabbis, Rav Dov Lior and Rav Yaakov Ariel? Oh, one more thing I should tell you. I know all the Rav Abadi shittas because my shul, West Orange, New Jersey, Or Torah, had a student of Rav Abadi as the rabbi for like 4 years. I think it's probably the only Abadi Talmud who ever was a rabbi of a modern Orthodox shul. And so all the unusual views. Okay, so in his Sefer, So I learned about these things, and I was curious. To find out what some of the other rabbis think. So, Or Yitzchak, volume one, number 80. He deals with what we dealt with last class, Shabbos candles. And he says, first of all, you know, we have the electric lights here. So what's this business of lighting Shabbos candles? Right? And what he says, first of all, is that you should focus on the electric lights, but because that's the real light. But then he says something really interesting. He says that Yom Tov, he says, you know, we light candles the second night of Yom Tov. How could you light candles the second? We know you're allowed to use fire, but if there's a purpose, how could you light a candle on the second night of Yom Tov? You already have light in the room. Well, what's the permission? And certainly he says to make a bracha on it. What's the bracha for? He thinks that the bracha on it, Shabbos candles in general, is not a real bracha because we have lights. Okay, so you can turn off lights, I guess, but on Yom Tov you can't. So he holds, listen to this, even though Minhag Yisrael is to do this, no one questions this. He says, on Yom Tov Sheni and Shabbos after Yom Tov, ein heter lahadlik, tahave malacha shol vatzorich. Because you can't light it. It's as simple as that. Now, I heard a shiur in my town in West Orange where someone asked Rav Schechter this very question, and Rav Schechter says, you know, it's a problem, and you should tend the lights. And he says, I don't know if you can light on the second day of Yom Tov. So I mentioned this to Rabbi Rekefet. He was giving a whole series of like 10 classes on this. I said to him that, but I'm sure if Schechter's wife lights, I mean, how is she not going to light? Well, so lo and behold, Rav Schechter was there the following week in Israel, and Rekefet asked him, and you can listen to Rekefet on his class. It blew his mind. He couldn't believe Rav Schechter says, no, she doesn't light. And so here you have the big posek, and he holds that everything we do is wrong, that all the lighting, candle lighting. So I wrote to Rav Dov Leor a few questions I asked him. The first had to do with this, and believe it or not, Rav Liardo only answers the first part. He says that he actually says that Ravadi is correct, that since there's a lot of electricity and you don't need all these lights, when you make the bracha on the light, you should also have in mind the electric lights. And any quotes with Tzvi Pesach Frank that you can make a bracha on electric lights. Then the next question I asked him dealt with Anita issue. We'll leave that aside. I asked him another question, actually two others, because we're about corn, what we call maize. If you haven't heard my class on Kitnios, it's not on YouTube, but it's because it was before we made this switch, but you can hear it on the Torah in Motion site. Ravadi held, I don't know if he still holds, because I heard a rumor he changed his mind, that corn is not Kitnios. Because for the reason we spoke about, that corn is a new world vegetable. And so I asked Rav Lior about this, and he says, no, it's definitely kitnios, because the Mishnah Berurah already says it's kitnios, and it's difficult to be moderate. One other thing, incidentally, I said, in the news that right now there's this Rabbi Eliezer Melamed. Rav Eliezer Melamed, let me show you what he looks like, and let me just take a look. Picture of him here. So let me pull you up the screen. If you follow the Israeli news, you know that he's been under a lot of controversy because he agreed to do a Zoom last week with a Reform rabbi and discuss certain things. And he actually just gave a talk, you see it on YouTube, explaining that, of course, we reject Reform, but they're still Jews and there's nothing wrong with talking to them, etc. He has an enormous amount of influence. If you haven't heard of him, you should have. Because since the publication of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, which was the most important halachic work in terms of popularity, that is not importance in terms of, you know, profundity, but how many was printed. No halachic work in modern times printed more than the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. It stopped really being popular maybe, even when I was in high school, we still used it. I don't think today people use it. But Rav Melamed has published, I think by now, it's close to 1 million of his classic work, Panine Halacha. How could someone publish a halachic work, 1 million? It is the standard work at all the religious Zionist schools in Israel. Every student uses it. It's the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch they use. And it happens to be a wonderful work. It's many, many volumes now, but they use like the Or HaChaim volumes. So why do I mention this? Because I had spoken in the classes on Kidneyos that according to strict halacha, that with the corn syrup, even if you hold corns is Kidneyos, the syrup should be Bato Barov. Let's even assume that syrup is an issue. It should be Bato Barov, and Bato Barov, the majority, you can use that. And I told you what Rav Aaron Felder told me, that it's the people won't accept it. Meshulam Zalman Arbach once called something similar, a kulash and a tzibriachal mobile. They can't accept it. If you look in Rabbi Malamed's book, someone who was listening to the classes later emailed me, and I checked, and it's absolutely true. Rav Malamed holds halacha lemaisa, that you can eat all these products that have corn syrup in it. The marshmallows I showed you, all these products, the elite chocolate, because it's Bato Barov, and that's Kidneyos. And being that his Sfarim are now the standard for the religious Zionist community, it shows you that's an enormous difference between what the Hashkachas in America practice and what they're doing in Israel. So let me stop sharing Rabbi Malamed there. Okay. The last question I asked him had to do with swordfish. We'll get, you can talk more to Rabbi Zivotofsky about that. And he says it's just a dispute. So here we have Rav Dov Lior also saying something which we're not usually accustomed to, saying that when you light the candles, you should have in mind the electric lights. Although if the electric lights are off, I don't know if you still would need to, but the point I think of Rav Vadi is that the electric lights are the main lights, so you shouldn't turn them off. They're the main lights. He didn't answer the question, which I was really interested in, about what about lighting the candles on Yom Tov Sheni. I sent this question also at the same time to another rabbi. And let's see if any of you recognize this rabbi. His name is Yaakov Ariel. I think he is today, after the passing of Rav Nachum Rabinovich a couple weeks ago, he is the most important of the religious Zionist halachic authorities. He was the Rav of Ramat Gan, author of many volumes of Tshuvot. He's also a thinker. They've published a volume of his, just like if they published a volume of Chaim Sabato and had conversations with Rav Lichtenstein, I think even in English things now, they published his conversations. We're dealing with someone who comes, B'nai Akiva background, went to Merkaz HaRav, but Merkaz is an interesting place because some of the people come out very closed-minded. Those are the ones who went to the, you know, Har HaMor, and others came out very open-minded and wide-ranging. I mean, he knows poetry, he knows philosophy. Unfortunately, he never was chief rabbi. He was the religious Zionist candidate for chief rabbi in, I think it was 2003 was the year. And the Haredim at that time were very involved. You know, they under Rav Yashiv, there's a complete change in the Haredi outlook. It used to be they wanted nothing to do with the chief rabbinate, they wanted nothing to do with the Dayanim of the chief rabbinate. But Rav Yashiv, who came from that world, he was a Dayan his whole life. He lived his whole life on a salary and then a pension from being a Dayan. He had a different philosophy, and the philosophy was to conquer the chief rabbinate. Yateid Ne'eman switched on a dime. When he became the Das Torah, all of a sudden they speak about how important it is. And therefore they decided that they have to put their people into the chief rabbinate. And there was an individual, his name was Yonah Metzger. If you don't know much about him, you can Google him. He's out of prison now. He never should have been allowed to run for chief rabbinate because he had already been banned from running for chief rabbinate in Tel Aviv. And yet the Haredim decided they would put him in. Some people claim that was about the Heter Mechira. I don't think so. I think it was they wanted to, had Rav Ariel been elected chief rabbi, he was a Gadol B'Yisrael. That's a problem. It's a lot easier for them to have a nobody, a chief rabbi, a yes man, just a figurehead sort of person. And they knew no one would take Metzger seriously, and no one took Metzger seriously. Even before his legal problems that got him sent to prison, no one took him seriously. He was he's a lightweight is even an understatement. And but that was the way, basically, to destroy the chief rabbinate. Remember, the chief rabbinate of Eretz Yisrael used to have the Godol B'Yisrael of the religious Zionist world. You had Rav Kook and Rav Herzog and Rav Gorin, who was a great guy, Rav Avraham Shapiro. Rav Lau was not at their league, but certainly is a very fine Talmud Chacham and did great things. In any event, so that's, if you haven't heard of Rav Ariel, it's because of that. But in Israel, everyone knows who he is, very important figure. So I wrote to him as well. And he says, his answer is a little different. First of all, I also asked him about the corn, and he says, yes, it's kitnios. And then I asked him about the Shabbos candles. And he says, when he got married, he went to Rav Pesach Frank to ask him some questions. And one of them was about how can we light Shabbos candles with a bracha when we have electricity? And he quotes Rav Pesach Frank as saying just the opposite of what Rav Lior says, that you can't make a bracha on electricity. And I looked this up. Rav Pesach Frank says different things in different places. So I don't know what his final opinion was. And then he says, he speaks about candles in a battery. Then you could, he explains, but not in a electricity. And if you go today, if you travel, you can't light Shabbos candles in hotels. You can get this from Sohar. They come up the Shabbos thing, a candle where you put a battery in and it lasts. That's the Shabbos candle. And as for the other question, he says that since we can't make a bracha on electricity, by lighting the candle, L'chavot Shabbos, that gives it a special kibbut. So we can make the bracha, even though we have lights, and our main light is the electricity, but the candles still give it a certain kavod, he says. And that solves the problem. He says, oneg Shabbos, we get with the chashmal, with the electricity, but kavod Shabbos, you know, candles, you go to a restaurant, a nice restaurant, they have candles. Candles do something, they add a certain atmosphere. He says that the candles give us the kavod Shabbos, which I think is very interesting. Okay, that gets us to, we have a few more in Orach Chaim, number Siman Chaf, number 20. And here from Rabbi Henkin, this goes back to Rabbi Henkin. Here I have to set the stage again. The title of the question is, Ha'im Nashim Motziot Gvarim Al Yedei Chovat Kiddush. Can a woman be motzi a man for Kiddush? Some people say it's even a problem for the man to be motzi the woman on Friday night because we already said Kiddush and Shul. But why did I ask this question? This is not, although in the second line of the tshuva here, he says, the Shoel, that's me, Lo Hiskir Universitat Brandeis, didn't mention Brandeis. We're getting back to Brandeis, but this is when I'm a student. And here's what happens. Brandeis, as I explained, you know, a very sort of very pluralistic type of environment. Everyone does their own davening, but of course you have to come together and eat together. It's all into that. So we come and we eat together. And what I saw when I was there, and everyone did, and some people were troubled, others not so much, but it was always very strange, is that since there's a big room of all sorts of people, someone else each week would say Kiddush. Actually, in theory, they'd give it to the Orthodox advisor or the conservative rabbi if they were there, but usually they had no interest, let the student do it. But then they give it to a woman. Okay, so a woman would say Kiddush because the conservatives, the women say Kiddush, the reform, the women say Kiddush. So you can always make your own Kiddush. People would make their own Kiddush. And it always created controversy because the Orthodox students didn't like it. In fact, sometimes they come back from Israel and they want to make a whole stink about it. And there's a certain logic. They said, it's not right because if we can't be Yotzei, it violates our principles. So for you to say Kiddush, look, if you're a conservative Jew, to say to a conservative woman, you shouldn't say Kiddush because it violates the Orthodox principles and it violates pluralism, it's not going to make much sense. But you can see the argument. You know, we're supposed to not, that's the reason why we have kosher. Reform doesn't believe in kosher, let's say, or they're not mocked on it, but we have to be kosher for everyone's sake. So it always was a controversy. This responsum, which is not to me, it's actually, because I'll tell you why, it's from 1990. Only when I wrote to Rav Henkin maybe when I was a senior in college, because finally I wanted to hear from a posseg. Is it such a problem? Because if you look in the Mishnah Berurah, if you look in the post game, they seem to say there's no problem at all. The Mishnah Berurah the Shulchan Aruch says explicitly in Reish Ayin Aleph that women, that women can be motzi men in Kiddush. And yet, you go to people's houses, you don't see them doing this. If you look in the Mishnah Berurah, however, he says in... He mentions the people who agree, the Taz, the Magid Avram, the Gra, and then he says, yet nevertheless, he quotes the Eliyahu Rabbah, you should be machmir, that the woman should not be motzi people who are not of her family. The Zila Milsa, you know, it's not considered appropriate. We'll see what Rav Hengen says about that. But even the Mishnah Berurah says, in the family, it's not an issue. So I was wondering what, first of all, you have the issue, you have to say Kiddush again. If the woman says it. And second of all, just in general, is this appropriate? So I asked Rabbi Hinkin. I just mailed him, and I just got a small letter back from him. That would have been 1989, I guess, saying it's not a problem. You don't need to make sure. You know, again, you could insist on this is going to create problems. So maybe it's better not to, but it's not such an issue. Now, in 1990, which is the tshuva number 20, is I was living in Cambridge and going to the Harvard Hillel. And the rabbi of the Harvard Hillel was none other than Rabbi Harry Sinoff. There are probably people online here who know who Harry Sinoff is. From Harvard Hillel, I think he was the principal in the school in Houston. Or I went to Denver, and then he was in Houston. I think now he's at the Berman Academy. Someone can write it in. I haven't kept up with who he is. But I was speaking to him, and he was saying to me, you know, again, they were having the same problem at Harvard. And, you know, so what to do? He served as the Orthodox rabbi at Harvard. So I told him that Rabbi Hinkin actually said it's not a problem. So he asked me for Rabbi Hinkin's address, and he wrote to Rabbi Hinkin. And the response that you have here is from Rabbi Hinkin to Rabbi Sinoff. Now, unlike the other tshuvot of Rabbi Hinkin I published, which all appear in his Sefer, this never appeared in the B'nai Vanim. I asked Rabbi Hinkin about this, and he said he didn't publish it in his Sefer. He has four volumes of Tshuvot for his own reasons. That's a quote. I think for his own reasons means he was afraid of being attacked or something like that. So, but he told me that I could publish it. And so he begins to Rabbi Sinoff. Obviously, Rabbi, I don't know Harry's Hebrew name, I guess Svi, but he obviously wrote to him in English, Harry, so it's Lichvod Harav Hei. And he begins by saying that, you know, I did get this question. When I wrote to him, I wasn't asking about Brandeis. I just was asking him in general about the women saying Kiddush. But he said, I didn't know about Brandeis. I just answered him, you know, shortly, that quick answer that women can make Kiddush for men. And certainly no one will say that diavad, you're not Yotzi. And then he goes into the more detailed, the different arguments, what I mentioned to you, the, you know, etc. He doesn't understand. So it's a somewhat long tshuva. He doesn't understand, you know, the Mishnah Berurah's point. He does acknowledge at the end that on page Mem Gimel that Jewish history, Masorah, I guess you can call it, the women did not say Kiddush for men. Although you can have, you know, there were women who would say Kiddush. Let's say the woman is a widow. She would say Kiddush. But he says something very interesting. He says, "Bavadoi lo hitragu nashim motzi gvarim b'kiddush." He says, certainly, women historically were not being motzi men for kiddush. V'uam sarich raya sheyesh bazeh mishum minhag. He says, but we need a proof that this is what we call a minhag. In other words, if you're going to tell me that women can't say kiddush for men because it's minhag Yisrael, what does minhag mean? We obviously don't want to break with minhag. But sometimes minhag is actually something positive you do. The fact that women didn't say Kiddush because men, they were married to men and the men said it, this doesn't mean that there's a minhag for women not to say Kiddush. It just means that the general practice is men said it. We have certain things where there's a minhag not to. For example, a woman technically could be a moel, but the minhag is not to. And we have other examples of this in all areas of Jewish life. So he says here, we don't have actually a proof that there's a minhag against women saying it. And he says, Harbe Nashim lo yadu kadesh batzman. Oh, havin roshan kodesh, as we saw already a couple weeks ago. Women didn't know Hebrew. So they couldn't say it. But that's not a minhag you know, telling him not to, that's due to the circumstances. And if the circumstances change and they can, then maybe things can be different. Obviously, the argument he's making is not going to fly in the more right-wing communities. I think we all appreciate that. But from what he's and communities he's dealing with, I mentioned last class that there was my daughter, till she went home, was at Lindenbaum and they had a woman's Megillah reading. You can find plenty of standard halachic sources that say a woman can be mostly another woman. Not a problem at all. On the other hand, you can also find sources that say it goes against men of Israel, you shouldn't do it, et cetera, et cetera. So this is going to be, I understand that for those listening right now and later on YouTube who come from a more right-wing community, more Haredi community, even the very question that a woman's going to say Kiddush, it's probably no different than a woman saying Hamotzi, you know? You come in, and I can't imagine there's any issue with a woman saying Hamotzi. But, you know, it would be, I understand how it's very strange, and but in the community, like I described, the Harvard Hillel, the Brandeis Hillel, you know, it's, you're trying to live. The people who decide to go to these places already made a decision that they're going to live in a more of like a pluralistic sort of, where there's this neutral ground where Jews of all denominations can come together, where no one's ideology or halachic practice will be negatively affected. Unlike certain colleges where, for example, the only kosher meal is at the Chabad. So there's a complete separation. And then he goes on to say, he says the Shulchan at the end, Shulchan Aruch's opinion, Verov Gedolei Achronim, most of the great Achronim, is that a woman is motzi a man in Kiddush Lechachila, just like the Levush says. And then he says, even to those who disagree, hold it b'diavad, it's okay. Then he says, therefore, in my opinion, efshar lahatzir l'nashim motzi anashim. He's telling her by sin off, in my opinion, at the Harvard Hillel there, you can allow women to make Kiddush. Of course, this gets into the other issue we spoke about last class. You know, if we're dealing with the Reform woman rabbi who's a heretic, then we have the same problem we had last class. But if you're not dealing with that, just in terms of a woman saying Kiddush, even Orthodox, because these college campuses have a lot of very liberal Orthodox women, Jofa people, etc. And if they're given a chance to say Kiddush, they're very happy to do it. So Rabbi Henkin rules, halacha l'maisa, the woman can say Kiddush, which means that men don't have to say their own Kiddush. The Rabbi Sinoff is supposed to tell the students not to make a big deal or anything about that. They can always make their own Kiddush if they want, but it's not an issue. And then he says, right at the very end, he says, and my grandfather, he permitted women to say Kaddish, because Kaddish brings people close to Judaism. Once again, this is not, in the modern Orthodox world, this is not an issue at all. No one will blink an eye if a woman's saying Kaddish on the woman's side of the Mechitza. I say the woman's side of the Mechitza, because Ramosha writes, Ram Soloveitchik said, they would even come then into the main shul and say Kaddish. But in many more right-wing places, and I have to say, I've been told by people, not only right-wing places, I was told by someone at a shul, which is not so right-wing, that when a woman said Kaddish, that they came over to her afterwards and said, the minhag there is heard not, unless a man is saying it, she shouldn't say it. But Rabbi Henkin, and she was very offended, as you can imagine, but Rabbi Henkin ruled that a woman could say Kaddish. And then why? Acharei Sheheresh in Rei Me'achronim. Oh, sorry, he says, since he showed there's no proof in the Achronim, the more recent authorities, to forbid it. And he says, Rav Henkin said, even Rav Henkin Sr., even though women never said Kaddish, nevertheless, it's not that there wasn't a minhag not to, just that women didn't go to shul, they weren't educated, that sort of thing. But there's no positive minhag saying not to say. And he says, that's the same thing here. He says, you should do like you want. Im roesha inyan nachutz yachol hatir. He says, if you think this is important, and if you're in a college setting and you don't want to create, you know, separatism, you want, and Kirov is also vitally important. I said, if anyone who's in that role, you're trying to bring in the non-Orthodox into the Orthodox dominion, if you appear to them as closed-minded, as you know, an extremist, it's going to really make your life difficult. They might even fire you, as we saw. So you can allow the woman to say Kiddush. I don't know what goes on today. It could be we're in a new era. Dor Chadash, Yakom Dor Chadash, that doesn't know about these sort of rulings, but this is the ruling, and it became very well known, I'm told, at different college campuses. And not only that, when I came back to Brandeis and I was working there, again, we had the problem of, you know, the students, and they were more strong, and they wanted to make an issue of it. And I showed them this tshuva of Rabbi Henkin, and that really put a stop to it. So that is Simon Chaf Aleph. We'll go another 15 minutes or so, and then I'll take the questions. The next tshuva, we return to Rabbi Greenblatt, Ephraim Greenblatt. The Rivavos Ephraim, as I mentioned, you know, the Talmud Mufak of Ramosha Feinstein. More tshuvot are addressed to Ramosha Feinstein than any other individual in the Igros Moshe. We're going to see next class, though, where Rav Greenblatt disagrees with Ramosha on one of the most important issues in the second half of 20th century, namely dealing with Balei Tshuva, having them over on Shabbos. I'll talk about that. Maybe we'll get to that today. But this is a more simple question, a run-of-the-mill or a Chaim question. No great chachmas here. But it was just a question I had. It's dated 1993. No presents on Shabbos. We usually told you're not supposed to get presents on Shabbos. What about the fact that we go to people's houses and we bring a bottle of wine? We cannot be justified. He explains that he goes into it. So there's some bit of a lengthy tshuva, well, not that lengthy page, but many of his that I got are small. And he explains how it's not really a problem. First of all, you're going to eat it at the Shabbos table, or at least you intend to eat it at the Shabbos table. Then he talks about the idea of that this is recorded in the earlier sources that they used to give presents to the chassan on Shabbos. And that became an issue, and the Aruch HaShulchan justifies it. Now, why would they give presents to the groom on Shabbos? Well, remember Fiddler on the Roof? You remember that scene where they're getting up and everyone's giving the present? It was Friday, I believe it was Erev Shabbos, if I recall. But that's when they used to have weddings in Europe, Erev Shabbos. They have the weddings because at least then everyone would get a meal. You know, we're not dealing with, you're not inviting people from all over. It's the community. And the poor people get a meal, and then the meal would go into Shabbos. The Ramah, Ramosha Isserles, has a famous tshuva where they were disputing, you know, the terms of the marriage. And it even was after Shabbos. And the question was, could they do the marriage on Shabbos? And in Ashas HaTachak, Hatzil Bas Yisrael, he allowed it, which is normally is never allowed. So you'd have, let's say, you'd have the meal on Shabbos, and people would get up and say, "You know, here's I give you a chicken or whatever." And the Aruch HaShulchan says it's a minhag Yisrael, and that it's sameach hasan bakala, and therefore you can do that. And so Rabbi Greenblatt says, you know, you could, although you could bring it before, but if you don't, it's all part of the Shabbos meal, et cetera, et cetera. And then he says, and if you can give a present to the Chasan Kala, also, this is Sarach Suda Shabbos. And then he says, V'tochol Amar Kach, the studenting, Kamosha Katatu, he said, you can tell this to the students, because I asked, you know, the students also, sometimes on Shabbos, they would eat in their apartments, and they had this question. And then he quotes the Sri Deish, that the Sri Deish has an interesting tshuva about bar mitzvah boys. They used to, I don't know if they still do. When I was young, you know, after the bar mitzvah, you're called up, the rabbi speaks to you, now you're a man, all that sort of stuff. And then they give you, in my show, in those days, I was bar mitzvah in 79, you got two presents, and I still have them, and they have the stamp in them. One was from the men's club, a sitter, the Birnbaum sitter. Remember that blue Birnbaum sitter, which you go into most shuls. You can't. I don't know what they did with all those Birnbaum sitters. Maybe you can get them cheap on used books, because every shul, that was the sitter, and the Hertz Chumash. And the Hertz Chumash was given by the shul, and I have it right behind me. I don't know if you can see it there. You see the encyclopedias, it's behind me, but you got the Hertz Chumash, and that was given from the shul. Again, the Hertz Chumash, they're also, they're an endangered species, it seems, in shuls today, but that was what we all grew up in. But the question is, can you give a present on Shabbos? Generally, Rabbi Weinberg says, well, according to many Rishonim, the metaltilin, you know, movable things is not a problem. And then he quotes sources that because it's it deals with Torah and it's a holy purpose, you can give it. And this too, which, you know, you're giving, even if they don't drink the wine on Shabbos, first of all, you have the shitas that it's not, there's no prohibition if giving, let's say, if I give you, let's say, if I, you know, just a movable item. And also, they could use it for Shabbos, and maybe they'll use it for Shal Shudas, and in general, they do use it if you bring it over often for Shabbos. So he says there's not a problem, and although in generally we don't give presents on Shabbos, this is an exception. I've noticed in some shuls they say we're giving you they say we're giving you the present, but you can be maknet after Shabbos or things like that. Okay, maybe that's better. But I remember when I got it, they didn't say that; they just gave you the present. And that's Simon Chafal. Today I can tell you when my brother actually. He's 9 years younger than me. When he was bar mitzvah, that would have been 1988. Already they weren't giving the Hertz Chumash. And they weren't even giving the Birnbaum Seder. That's Art Scroll had already been out since like 85. But my, my brother would be 88. My brother was given Sefer HaChinuch. It's the Sefer HaChinuch in English, the Weingrove edition, that was what they were giving. Not the whole thing, it's like five volumes, but one volume was, or two volumes were from the shul, and one volume was from the men's club. My son just graduated his high school, and they gave him the new Koran Siddur as a present. It's huge. It's like 1,300 pages. He told me it's too big. He doesn't want to take it to Israel. It doesn't fit into the film bag. I got to get him a smaller one. It has everything in it, this new Koran. I had never seen it before. We have time. Oh, we have time for one more. I'll skip number 22. It's a Muktzah question. 23, also to Rav Greenblatt, deals with, I was wondering about tying the knot on a Sefer Torah on Shabbos. You know, we're not supposed to make knots. Sometimes they make maybe make a double knot. You know, make a bow, but it's a double bow. So isn't that a knot? He doesn't think it's a knot. He thinks it's, well, he says it's like a bow, but maybe he's assuming it's a single one. And it's a kesher, a real tie. If you can open it easily, I guess it wouldn't be a problem either. Beis Anivos. Okay, the next question, Chaf Dalit. You see, we're not going to get to the really interesting one about the Baal. Maybe we'll get to Chaf Hey. I'll set the stage at least. Chaf Dalit deals with something, Rav Abadi's very make you on this. So when you have alarms, and many of you have alarms, you walk in and out, a light goes on in your house on Shabbos. Sometimes it's just a little on the screen. So is that, this goes way back, this late 1980s I wrote. So I'm wondering, is that halakhically permissible? It's a, you don't intend it, it doesn't mean anything, but nevertheless, but he said that he asked the organization, the company to turn off the light. And that's, you can get it done in my house in all of West Orange. You can, they make it so that when people go in and out, every time you open the door, when the alarm's not off, the light doesn't go on. Is it a real issue? Rav Abadi doesn't think it's an issue. Rav Rabinovitz, I don't know. It's doesn't seem like it's much different than walking down the street. It's even less when the lights go on. But that's what he said. If you can do it, if you can easily get it done, and they can, where the lights don't do anything as you go by, he says to do that. Now, in the footnote, he says as follows. This is the sort of thing that other people might not have printed. Huntress Yesode HaTorah Shel Shadal Nachutz Ma'od Todah Shashalachli. Shadal is Shmuel David Watzatam, not the typical yeshivish sort of person. He wrote a work called Yesode HaTorah. Very interesting work in of its own sake, but we're dealing with one of the like religious maskilim. You can read about him on Wikipedia, other places. I sent it to him because this work, Yesodei HaTorah, it's like the sort of, in the Haredi world, they'll never read Shadal. Partly because, first of all, he did not believe in Kabbalah. In his youth, he was like a Mekubal, but then he rejected it and he has a thing called Vikuach HaChachmas HaKabbalah. And also, he goes against the Rambam. He really does not like the Rambam's philosophy and he's very, very harsh. about the Rambam. Unlike Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, who only did this in one work, his first work, 19 Letters, where he also attacks the Rambam. He goes so far as to say that is Moses ben Maimon really, his ideas are identical to Moses, the son of Amram? And he really attacks the Rambam for bringing Greek ideas. And Shadal does this, but he continues to do it. And Shadal contrasts the Rambam and Ibn Ezra on one side, who he thinks, you know, did terrible things to Judaism through their philosophy, and Rashi and Yehuda Levi and the Ramban on the other side, who they are really authentic Judaism. Now, if you actually look what Shadal's talking about, he's not talking about the Mishnah Torah, he's talking about the philosophy, I guess Sefer Mada would be included, which they don't study in the right-wing world anyway, the philosophy, but the idea that, you know, a 19th century personality can attack the Rambam, it is chutzpahdik. And but if you just take his work, Yesodei HaTorah, it's really a wonderful work, and you could remove, if you don't know who wrote it, there's only one attack against the Rambam in it. He talks about how the Rambam thinks that Avraham, what did Avraham teach Yitzhak? He taught him the golden mean, you know, the Aristotelian philosophical golden mean. And Shadal says that's not what Avraham taught, the golden mean. He was teaching him, you know, he said the true value of Judaism is chemla, he calls it, you know, kindness to others, etc. And so he only goes after the Rambam one time in there. And other than that, it's a very nice work. And it's definitely in the Orthodox mainstream, in the sense that YU published a translation of it in the 1960s. They used to have a series called Studies in Torah Judaism. And I think the second of their books is the translation of the Yesodei HaTorah of Shadal. But I was having, with Rabbi Greenblatt, we were, you know, conversing and writing, and I was introducing him. I don't know, maybe, I don't know why I felt this, but I felt that, like, I wanted to introduce him to things that he knew nothing about. Here he knows Shas and Poskim and everything, and he's been learning his whole life, but he never heard of Shadal. He never read it. So I figured I'd send him Shadal. I sent him some other stuff. I asked him, does he want Tversky's biography of the Raivad? And we had an interesting relationship. Okay, the last tshuva we're going to do for tonight, number 25, Orachayim, tshuvas dealing with Orachayim go to 33. This deals with a few things, but the first one is the big one. And the title is, Hazmanat Yehudish Eino Shomer Torah U'mitzvot L'Lel HaSeder. Can you invite a Jew who is not Torah observant to the Seder? And the issue is not just the Seder. The issue is any time, Friday night, etc. What's the problem? The problem is, by you inviting him, you're going to cause him to drive, or encourage him to drive. You know, we say, the question is, can you invite a Jew who's not Shomer Shabbos to the Seder? Now we have new questions in Rav Mazuz's most recent Sefer, just came out a few weeks ago. It's amazing that a rabbi in B'nai Brak could write this. He deals with the question, inviting a Jew who's intermarried. Can you invite them to the Seder? Because there's a problem of inviting a non-Jew on Yom Tov meals, so you might cook more for them. And he rules that you can, because the non-Jewish wife is sort of attached to the husband. But can you imagine this question? 50 years ago, could anyone even, and the question came from France, by the way. But can anyone imagine 50 years ago, an Orthodox family, but things have changed in the last 30 years, that you're going to have people in your immediate family, and you're going to invite them, you're going to want to invite them. So I wrote to Rabbi Greenblatt, because I was curious as to what he would say. Let's be honest here, Kiruv would be impossible if you didn't have people over. People are living in all over the place. And if you can't have them over your house for Friday night dinners or have them at shul, there's no way to reach them. The question is this allowed? Now, when I wrote to Rabbi Greenblatt, I don't think I knew Rav Moshe's position, which makes it even more interesting, because Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was so influential and who the Orthodox community in America is so much molded by him, his position on this issue is not listened to at all. He held that this is absolutely forbidden. You cannot invite someone over. He was asked the question originally about encouraging to come to shul if they're going to drive, but it's the same issue. Rav Moshe doesn't just think, he thinks it's you're actually assisting a sinner. You're enticing them to sin by inviting them. Now, the fact that they're going to be driving anyway, that is neither here nor there. You can't. And he was very firm on this. And yet, that's not the practice today. Why not? And then we'll get to what Rabbi Greenblatt says in a minute. It's because Or Sameach, in the 1980s, I think it was the 80s, not the 70s, asked this question for Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, which itself raises all sorts of issues. Because why did Or Sameach ask for Shlomo Zalman Auerbach this question? They asked him because they weren't happy with what Rav Moshe said. Had Rav Moshe permitted this, Or Sameach would have said, okay, because they have Or Sameach, they know, and all their rabbis know that you need to be able to invite people on Shabbos to experience a Shabbos meal and things like that. And they live too far away and not going to stay at your house. So they're looking for a heter. Had Rav Moshe given the heter, they never would have asked for Shlomo Zalman. Rav Moshe did it. Rav Moshe said it's forbidden. So Or Sameach turned to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Maybe Rav Shlomo Zalman can give a heter. Is that a problem? Think about this for a minute. Is it okay to look for a heter? On the one hand, people are always looking for a heter. That's why they're asking the question. When you ask the question, you're looking for a heter. Otherwise, you wouldn't ask the question. It would just be forbidden. But I mean, can you pick a rabbi that you think is going to give a heter? And then if you know that this rabbi will say no, can you go to someone else? Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach himself, when abortion questions would come to him, he would send them to the Tzitz Eliezer, it's recorded, or Eliezer Waldenberg, because his approach was that I'm machmir on this. Honestly, I'm going to conclude stringently. And the person who's coming to ask the question is coming to get the permission. That's the whole reason for the question. And therefore, at least send to Rabbi Waldenberg, he might be able to come up with a permission. With Agunas, we do this all. Mamzerim, all the time they do this. They try to find a big posseg. If this posseg can't find a permission, you go to another one. So I know people say you shouldn't shop for a terim, but it's done all the time. And that's what Or Sameach was doing. They chose to ask the question of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, knowing Rav Moshe disagreed, because they thought it was very important. And I don't know if Rav Moshe would just think it's a problem. You know, if another reputable gadol was able to come up with their permission, oftentimes you see big rabbis say, okay, well, you can rely on him. He, you know, it's not my opinion, but you can rely on that. And Rav Shlomo Zalman's opinion was that you could invite the person. What you should do is you should let the person you invite know that they could stay at your house on Shabbos. And then if they chose not to, it's up to them. And I don't even know, that's for an individual or maybe a family. If you're dealing with like a family of 10 people or you have a whole group and you know they live far away and they're not going to stay, you know, a family with 5 kids is not going to stay in your apartment. So I don't know if Shlomo Zalman would say that that's forbidden, or just we assume they're not going to stay. You can ask them, but what, they're going to sleep on your couch? You have a one-bedroom apartment, the families will sleep on your couch? All the Or Sameach people assume that even if you have a studio apartment, you can still invite these people, and because it's understood they're not going to stay anyway, and they're going to leave. And that becomes the, whether Shlomo Zalman would have approved of all of that or not, that's the Chabad approach. That's Shlomo Zalman approach. And that becomes the standard, and that's all the Chabad Minyanim do this, and even the Lakewood Minyanim and everyone does that. They assume that, it's they're driving, that's on them. Rav Moshe Sternbach, incidentally, who's known as a big extremist, but he, despite his extreme views on Israel and all sorts of other things, he has an understanding of the Kirov movement more than many others because of his time in South Africa. And so Johannesburg is full of Balei Tshuva. And he, even before Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, thought that this wasn't an issue at all. Because when we invite them to come for Shabbos, we're doing it for their own good. Just like you can violate one Shabbos to save someone so they can observe many, we don't want them to sin. They're going to be sinning anyway. We're doing it for a good purpose. So he thought it was not a problem at all. And I guess in South Africa, in his community, already from early on, they were doing that. We'll get to, I see it's already 9:30, so we'll get to what Rav Greenblatt has to say, because next week, but just to anticipate, Rav Greenblatt is not going to be following Rav Moshe. Now, how does the Talmud Mufak not follow his Rebbe's position on this? I'll read you what he wrote to me, and look, every Talmud is also able to be independent, but generally Rav Greenblatt is not a Refreshal Schechter. Refreshal Schechter has no problems disagreeing with Rav Soloveitchik and offering his own views on a number of occasions. But Rabbi Greenblatt basically generally follows Rav Moshe down the line, but I never asked him why. I wish I did. I think he might have said that, you know, in this Zashasa D'chak, or I don't know. But we'll read what Rabbi Greenblatt has to say next class. We're going to get into, next week, we're going to get into a figure, Rav Yosef Masas. If you haven't heard of Rav Yosef Masas, here, let me show you. If you've been with me to Morocco, you know Rav Yosef Masas. But here, they even have a Facebook page devoted to him, I saw. But here is Rav Yosef Masas. Very unusual, original posek from Meknes in Morocco. Wait till you hear about some of the things he said. But this, we'll be back in Morocco next class. Got a few more in Orachayim. Okay, some lots of interesting stuff. I think next week is the last class. Oh, and we get to Rav Herschel Schechter. Interesting stuff from Rav Herschel next week as well. But it's already 9:30, so let me stop and take some questions. Lots of questions, comments here. Yes, Mati B. As I the other tshuva I dealt with the Nida issue. Maybe I'll get into that later, but I'm not so comfortable speaking publicly. Aren't Rabbi Abadi's sons involved in the websites? Yes, there's two websites, and they're run by different sons. Baruch says, it's not solely his position about the photographers. So I think some Hasidim have that too. Women photographs on women's side, maybe some others too. Well, could be. All I know is that I worked for a place, it was a catering facility in Staten Island called Simcha by the Sea when I was in high school. Well, they'd have Sheva Brachos and things on Shabbos, and then he started doing weddings. I did a lot of weddings, and we had, this is like Borough Park weddings, Gedolim, and Haredim, and Hasidim, and I don't think in my life I ever saw women photographers just for the women's side. The main photographer, many of these, was the same one who was at my bar mitzvah, and he just passed away a couple of weeks ago. Trainer. Remember Trainer Studios? This will take you back. You're from the New York area. He did all the, he invented the Gedolim pictures in America, as far as I know. I mean, you could get the framed pictures of all the different, that was Trainer Studios in Borough Park. To YWK, I know the Chavisai are here, but if you have a civil authority, I'll look at it. Send it to me, by the way. What did you say about serving cold cuts on Shabbos? Well, not on Shabbos. Cold cuts on a... if I said Shabbos, I made a mistake. I thought I said milchik dishes. You put a cold cut on a milchik dish. So what's the problem from the Shulchan Aruch's position? Chaim Soloveitchik mentions this example in his... not his famous article, Rupture and Reconstruction. In another article he wrote, in which he made the point, which he repeated again in Rupture, that much of what we do is not based on halacha, it's based on ritual instinct, it's based on how we developed in our communities. I'll give you a perfect example of this in a minute. And he says that he remembered how surprised he was when he went to Yoredeya, and he saw that, you know, what's the problem with cold cuts and a dairy pipe? But no one would dream of doing something like that. He gave, there's a story. If anyone knows Chaim, you can ask him this. I've heard this from many people, but I don't know if it's a legend. But if not, it's a good story anyway. Supposedly, when Chaim's mother, the Rav's wife, she was in a hospital. She came home from the hospital and she saw the sink and all the, you know, dairy and meat plates were in it together, and she started going crazy. And you're trafing up everything. And supposedly, I know the Chaim told the story, if it's not exactly what I'm telling you, very similar in RCA convention. Supposedly the Rav said, what's the problem? The Shulchan Aruch said it's mutter. And she is said to have replied, your Shulchan Aruch is going to trafe up my kitchen. So, when you think about what this means, and since we mentioned Rav Abadi, I can tell you something I witnessed with my own eyes. I told you about the rabbi, the Abadi student at the shul. So he gave a pre-Pesach thing to the women about how kashering the kitchen before Pesach. And he told them stuff like, you don't need to cover your countertops. And he starts explaining, you know, and they wouldn't accept it. They weren't accomplished. They said, they thought he's crazy. Of course, you got to cover your countertops. So I said to him later, he didn't understand. You know, they want to make their life more difficult. I said to him that, okay, you hold, you don't need to. I said, but there's a lot of things that you're not obligated to do, but we do it anyway. And there's a lot of things we are obligated to do according to the sources, but we don't do, for whatever reason. According to the sources, you're supposed to wash If you eat a wet food, you're supposed to wash. And for hundreds of years, people haven't been doing it, and they wonder why, except for Pesach, we do it two nights. So, I mean, Yaakov Katz has developed the idea of a ritual instinct, that communities develop in a certain way. But that was Chaim Soloveitchik's point, where the rabbi telling the women that they don't need to cover the countertops, and the women saying the rabbi doesn't always know what he's talking about. And what do you get to tell them? You explain about, you know, Eroi, you know, you pour it, and the hot, and the this, and the that. And if you don't cover it during the year, why would you want to cover it on Pesach? But that's looking at halacha just through the texts, not through the way it's developed. And you have to see Chaim Soloveitchik's piece where he talks about this idea how the kitchen was the domain of the wife, and what happened in the kitchen was passed down from her mother and grandmother, and that need not be in line with the halacha. It followed its own approaches. Mutti says corn syrup shouldn't be a problem. Well, you can listen to the talk I gave on kidney yolks. The corn syrup, there's two reasons why corn syrup shouldn't be a problem, and you can drink regular Coke. One is if you hold that syrups b'chol are not an issue. But the other one, and that's what Rav Melamed says, is that according to the halacha, kidney yolks are batel barov. So the non-Jews put it in. Now, I asked Rav Schachter, and he didn't want to accept that because he thinks, apparently, that they put it in anyway as part of the general procedure. It's not like it falls in. But I think most assume that if the non-Jew does it, it is batel. And that's what he... David says, not so. You're right. Somet does all the special stuff. In fact, I was just reading yesterday, Somet is in the news... As I recall, they have a thermometer now, a new thermometer where you can do it, use it on Shabbos. Linair is the product. Yes, I bring it with me always to Europe. Does the Rav say that candles add a certain dignity? Could be, I don't know. But that's what Rav Ariel says. So Rav Mel says, Rabbi Sinoff lived in Highland Park. How can a woman be a mohel if she herself is not obligated in Mila? Well, take a look in the Shulchan Aruch and what they say technically. I don't know. Why did she? Who says she has to be obligated to the Emoah? Larry says, I heard from people that Rabbi Manny Rackman, when he was rabbi in Far Rockaway, would go on Friday night after davening and recite Kiddush for the widow women in the community. I also saw that. But that's because the women don't know or they don't feel comfortable. But they could be. Could it be problematic for women to motzi up men for Kiddush due to covet of Sibor? In and of itself, it's problematic to engage in Kriyas HaTorah. When you're at the setting I'm talking about, covet of Sibor is basically not actionable in that sense. The women are giving Divrei Torah. The women are doing all sorts of stuff. So the idea that there would be a problem for the women saying Kiddush really isn't, in those circles, is not that relevant. So the woman is Moses, not being Motzi anything. She's physically circumcising the child. As I said about Motzi, we get out of it Friday night because as Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim, we don't say that in davening, but I think it's Rabbi Akiva Eger who says he wonders why the man should be able to motzi the woman Friday night because he already said Kiddush and Shul. So so why should he be able to? Regarding the alarm, Sikresha, Dunichale, Isser Torah. Well, Rav Abadi and Rav Rabinowitz do not hold it to Isser Torah, that little light coming on. Shadal amends the text of Nach. Yes, he does, but not the Torah, only Nach. And yes, of course, he's controversial. I said he's controversial. In my book, Studies in Maimonides and His Interpreters, I publish a very long essay by these, I think there were three of them. They were called the Ro'im, like from Ro'eh, attacking Shadal. The Satmar in the 1990s published a number of volumes cheaply. It's called a place called Copy Corner. I helped them because they came to Harvard. I gave them any books to copy. And they didn't realize who Shadal was. So they also included in their catalog Shadal as what I'll tell you, the Minchas Yitzhak, if you look at Yitzhak Yaakov Weiss, he quotes Shadal. You can Google this, you can find in the Bar Ilan or Otzer Chachma. She quotes Shadal, what Shadal says about they had a case where someone refused to circumcise his son. Can he be part of the community? And all the rabbis were saying, nope. If you don't circumcise your son, you're not part of the Kehillah. And Shadal also was asked this question. And in this volume of all the great rabbis, you have a letter from Shadal there blasting this father. And the Minchas Yitzchak, we're talking Eda Charedis, you know, really far on the right, he quotes the Chacham Shadal, who has also a proof. Didn't I do a whole series of Ramasas? I did, both Rav Sholem and Rav Yosef. Well, the Rav said Lubavitcher Rebbe sent couples who wanted to adopt to him. Yeah, the Lubavitcher Rebbe did not support adoption because of yichud issues and male, you know, touching, you know, the children if they're not biologically related. Rav Moshe Sturmach isn't necessarily an extremist. He's unpredictable in Pesachim. Yeah, he's an extremist on matters relating to Israel. Just like Satmar and others are extremists on that. But if you look at their Pesachim, the Satmar Rav could have lenient Pesachim. There are even Kippah, Sruga, religious Zionist rabbis, not only religious Zionist rabbis, one of the chaplains in the Israeli army who wrote a sefer on army halacha would go to Rabbi Sternbach. Now, Rabbi Sternbach doesn't believe in an army. He doesn't believe in a state of Israel, any of that. And yet, one of the chaplains would go to him, and he quotes him, to ask him questions. And in England, you have many of these people in England who would go to Rabbi Sternbach, and these are regular United Synagogue type rabbis, and ask him questions because he's from England and he understands. Trainer had a fetish of ladders for group pictures. Okay. At my bar mitzvah, he didn't do it. Did I work at Simcha B'Yassi Sea Blizzard of 83? Someone asked me. I worked almost every Shabbos in 83, so I can't remember the blizzard, but I'm sure I was there. I worked every single Shabbos in 83 and 84, even 82, most Shabbos. That's where I met their Feinstein family, Rav Dov Schwartzman, many, many others. So. True story, Mrs. Soloveitchik told the Rav she had Masorah from her mother how to keep a kosher kitchen. The Rav's from her mother, yeah. The Rav's mother was also, well, the Rav's mother had certain, she was a Talmid Chacham also when she had certain opinions. So there's someone says, the Rav at Chinuch Atzmai, the speech at Chinuch Atzmai you can hear online. He speaks about ritual instinct, four more things. The Rama says that a woman should not serve as a moel. This is the Shach and the Aruch Shochan, yeah. The Shochan Aruch says yes, right. The Rama says no. What I meant to say actually was shochet. I didn't mean to say moel. A woman technically can be a shochet. But then they say, well, maybe she can't, she's not strong enough. But by ophos, you know, we have Kabbalists that women given permission to shecht chickens, because women in Italy in particular, the men would go away on business trips for 2-3 weeks and there'd only be women there, so the women would shecht it, but the minhag is not to shecht it. Just even if you can show halachic sources that they can, and that's where Henkin is saying, his argument at least, is that there's no minhag not to say Kaddish, just they didn't say Kaddish. This argument of Rabbi Henkin was used also with the women's prayer groups. If you look in I think it's in Berkowitz's book, Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz's book. He says that there's no minhag against women's prayer groups. It's just they didn't do that. I don't know, it's a little bit of a thin line there. When does the fact that people didn't do it for 2,000 years, willy-nilly, to use a term of the Rav, become a minhag? Does a minhag have to be something you consciously think of, or the fact that you don't do it, that's also minhag Yisroel. Let's not forget that most of the things Jews did for thousands of years, they didn't think about it either, consciously. They just did it, and we assume that that's minhag. So I don't know. I'm a little question that a little bit. Check out the book Fixing God's Torah by B. Barry Levy as to what changes the Chumash were made to make the Torah agree with the Zohar. What you have is we have the disputes among the Masoretes, and even Rashi's Sefer Torah is not the same as ours. You can see in one of the commentaries in Bereishis, the Rashi explains why there's this extra vav, and in our Chumash it doesn't have an extra vav in it. So Barry Levy wrote a book dealing with how the Torah text became the Torah text. There's a big dispute, and believe it or not, we don't follow what all the poskim say to do. All the poskim, the Rashba and the rest, all say when there's a dispute between what the Masoretes say and what the Gemara says, when it deals with halacha, we go like the Gemara. And yet our Torahs are not like that. Our Torahs go by what the Masoretes said, even if it goes against what the Gemara says, because the rabbis were not writing the Sifrei Torah. The scribes were writing it, and they followed their own tradition. If you wonder why all our Sifrei Torah are the same today, it's not because of any magical thing. It's because of the rise of printing. before the rise of printing, Sifrei Torah were different. You had all sorts of differences. And even to this day, if you go into, let's say, Lakewood, and you pick, go to every shul there and take Sifrei Torah, you will find that at least half the Sifrei Torah are different. How are they different? How do I know this? I know this because the people who do the computer checks, and they have pictures and examples, testify that about half of every Sefer Torah they check has errors in it, has changes in it. So I just use the word errors. What's the definition of an error? If we today consider an error what Rashi considered the proper text, and already the Gemara says we don't know what the Pliny and defective, the Male and Chaser. So the fact that we all have and we know what a Sefer Torah is today, that's only because of printing. And it goes back to the Ramah, Rameir HaLevi Abulafia, and the Mincha Shai, and they determined what our Torah scrolls are. And even today as we speak, there's still a few changes. The word Daka doesn't have an Aleph or a Hey. Is it Vayihi Yimei Noach, Vayu Yimei Noach? But these are small changes. Okay, well, we don't need to talk about that. Changes, we don't know. The Gemara cites psukim that are different. You look at Rabbi Kiva Eger in Shabbos, I think it's Nun Vav or Nun Gimel, he has a list. We have psukim that are cited in the Talmud, and we have actually old manuscripts of the Torah that are different, that have small differences. Mostly just extra vavs here and there, so nothing really. But if you look in the Dead Sea Scrolls, you have more significant differences. So the Gemara speaks about, actually it's the Sifrei, and it's Yerushalmi, and they speak about that what they did in the days of the Beis Hamikdash, they had three Sifrei Torah, which were thought to be the letter perfect ones, and they found differences, and they went by majority. Al Harov. And that's how, and that's what Rameir HaLevi Abulafia did in his work on Masoret Siagot Torah. He took the best Torahs that he could find in Spain, and he decided based on that, based on majority, what is considered. So our Torahs are not letter perfect in the sense that we could say, this is Moshe Rabbeinu's Torah. The Rambam didn't adopt that approach. The Rambam's approach was to take what the Aleppo Codex, well, it wasn't called it then, but the Ben Asher, he thought that was the most perfect text. And the Ben Asher text is different than our Torah text, because the Ben Asher text says, Vayiyu, Yimei Noach, not Vayihi. And you have other differences, for example, in Hazinu. Is it 60, is it 70 lines or 67? No. And yes, the Hav says that the reason for no brach on completion of the writing Sefer Torah, that I hadn't heard, but the reason they give for that is why you don't take a new Sefer Torah out if you find a mistake in Mali and Chaser, because you say you might find it in the next one as well. Someone says simpler, I think the Shagas Aryeh is a reason as to why, because we can't be 100% sure. I quoted in my book, he says, he has another thing about that. We don't have the Aleppo Codex. No, the Aleppo Codex is missing almost all of the Torah. It only has a little bit of the Torah. So we don't have it. What we have, however, is we have testimony of the Aleppo Codex, because we have a number of people who saw it and wrote about the different changes. Whether it's missing or not, yes, Matty Friedman in his book, his argument is that it actually made it to Eretz Yisrael intact. And from making it to Israel intact, then it disappeared, and it's out there somewhere. And he basically accuses the great scholar Meir Ben-Ayahu of pilfering it. You can read that book. Last comment, question. Much of it is preserved in letters that are written to scholars of Aleppo communities over the world. Yes, you have Rav Shmuel Salant. They sent someone in Halev Anon. The best thing is Jordan Penkauer has his book, deals with the testimony going back hundreds of years of someone who went through it and determined what was in there. So we know what was in the Aleppo Codex in the Chumash, and we also have the Yemenite tradition. And the Yemenite tradition is basically identical with everything we know about the Aleppo Codex. So, but our Torah is not the Aleppo Codex. Our Torah scrolls go back to the decisions of Rameir HaLevi Abulafia, who would have gone with the Aleppo Codex if he had it, because he says he doesn't have it. So he went by the majority, and then filtered through the Or Torah of Menachem Lanzano, and the Mincha Shai, and then even later, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, Shlomo Gottfried wrote a work, but really it's Lanzano, Or Torah, the Mincha Shai. That's where our Torah scrolls come from. So when someone gets up and talks about, and I'll end with this, this rabbi who wrote this book with the Reform rabbi, I forgot his name, Reinman. So Reinman writes this book with the Reform rabbi, created all this controversy. And as a proof of the truth of Torah, Reinman says that he does a couple of